Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalists. Oh boy, as I always say, and even more so than before, they absolutely got it correct. Or I usually say they absolutely got it right. Some people think that that means way off to the right. Well, no, the Anti-Federalists had it perfectly in the middle. And this is Tom Nivolus, your host here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty does work for you. And this has been a very, very interesting last 2 weeks. I appreciate that many of you were gone vacationing or observing either Passover or Christmas, or not Christmas, boy, I'm already ahead of myself, Easter. Because to me, the two really tie together, and if you understand the Puritans, they celebrated neither. Because in reality, if you look from a Reformation perspective, is that both of them are, what do you call them? They're really holidays developed just to tied to things that really aren't biblical from a tied holiday, but the idea of remembering what it was that, you know, Christ did come to earth in his birth, and then the resurrection is absolutely it is the most significant event of God's mercies and grace, because it overcomes death and defeats the devil in a way that he never expected, I think, that God would do in his great wisdom and mercy towards humankind. If you want a real simple idea of that and what that means, check out C.S. Lewis's books, the Narnia series, and the very first book, and then the very first movie, I think, was well done. It represents it. It is a course in understanding of that redemptive idea that mankind, because they don't care, and we're going to talk about mankind not caring a lot today, as well as the evil, the demons. There is demons, there are devils, there are all of that, and they, not knowing the wisdom of God, it just took them by surprise. They thought they could take and kill Christ, and that would be the end of it. But in fact, the death of Christ was all in God's plan, and the resurrection was all in his authority and showing his kingship and ownership over everything in the universe. So with all of that said, I wanted to take us down a path that this week, and like I started, the last couple of weeks is kind of disconcerting in a lot of different ways. You know, people are out there in media, both sides. I don't care if you're one that listens to Fox or any of the other blogs and all this, that, and the other thing. And what's going on from Syria to North Korea to domestic policy to all of these different things. And then definitely if it is the leftists or the communist media, because I'm not afraid to call it what it is. Because if you understand what has happened over the last 100 years, that influence and the terminology of progressive and leftist is absolutely tied into the evils of socialism, communism, Gransky-ism, Marxism, so on and so on and so forth. And then on top of that, you have the additional evil of Sharia and radical Islam that takes and is capitalizing on things. I mean, I just read this morning was that, so the Supreme Court says that schools can't force kids to go through the Sharia stuff. So that happened this week in the Supreme Court. But then you have the San Diego School District this week takes and says, oh no, they're going to teach Sharia in the schools. So here we go, folks. Somebody better start standing up. And this goes to everything that I'm going to talk about today, is that we need to be people of action. The problem, and we're going to go back to a good friend of mine that I know in spirit, let's say, and what he has to say relative to all of these various issues, and even to the extent of a number of people that may be listening today. I mean, there's a number of people that I always say, hey, you're the ones that do definitely get your butts out of your seat and your feet on the street, but at the same time, there's a lot of people that prefer to sit in B&M and listen to a whole bunch of stuff and think that they have stuff, and then they get on social media and they B&M on social media and they say all these things and they put up all these posts. But when they're asked to commit in action or finances, they don't do anything. They're deadpan. It's deadpan. And it's really, really interesting as we go through. That was predicted. It was predicted by the anti-federalist, and it was also predicted by this very good friend of mine who we'll talk about in a few minutes. But I wanted to take you really even deeper into the past a little bit. Back into the 1500s even. So this was during that Reformation period. And here's something here that was very interesting, and I thought it kind of fits into everything that we're looking at in the two sides of what's happening in American political dynamics. And so this one, take into context that this was back in that 16th century, and it starts out like this. This paragraph goes, "It is a thing well becoming the majesty of an emperor to acknowledge himself bound to obey the laws. Our authority depending on the authority of the laws, and in very deed to submit the principality to law, is a greater thing than to bear rule." So I'm going to stop there for a second. In the middle of this paragraph is what he's saying is that the rule of law is greater than ruling, all right, greater than the political dynamics, is the determination of the rule of law. So he continues in this paragraph, "We therefore make it known unto all men by declaration of this our edict that we do not allow ourselves to repute it lawful to do anything contrary to this." That was actually written by and in a very interesting argument in that 1500 period by Henry III, who happened to be at that time it was written by Philip du Plessis Mornay, and he was a Huguenot leader, and he was the chief advisor to Henry. King Henry of Navarre, who ultimately became Henry IV of France. Now, what du Plessis Mornay was writing about was what was happening in that period of time where the Huguenots were being slaughtered. There was this thing called the St. Bartholomew Massacre, where the Catherine de Medici, a radical Catholic of the day, set up this whole thing for a marriage for Henry III, before he became Henry IV, to get married and get married in France. Thousands of Huguenots came in, and they hated the Catholics, in particular in France and that area there, so hated what was going on with the Reformation that this Catherine set this marriage up in such a way that she would have this next person in line, which was this Henry III, murdered. Well, the St. Bartholomew Massacre murdered thousands of people. Henry was able to escape. He was wounded, but he was able to escape and later become King of France. And the interesting thing is that I'm not going to get into all of those other components of it, but what Philip du Plessis Mornay wrote then was a treatise, as some people call it, as a defense of liberty against tyrants. Now, this is some of the stuff that Sam Adams would have read. It would have been some of the readings, the history of the Reformation. It would be history of political theory. It would be the history of the components of that which Thomas Jefferson would read. Sam Adams, a number of the others that were the founders, and especially the Puritans would have reference to this because of the Puritan movement that came up larger out of England, and a lot of their own insanities that happened in England after Henry VIII and so on and so forth. But, you know, when you look at this, I have to say is that this question, and why this was important to me, is because when I was looking back at Sam Adams and working with the SACPS.org to define through the policies and what is policy and how does policy come about, what are the internal influencers of policy in humanity, and how does that then become expressed within the political system? And we're going to talk about even more derivative of that in the next segment, but I went back and I started looking, and I'm going, holy smokes, this is real interesting when I take this first question of what was written here and look then at Samuel Adams' master's dissertation. You have to remember, Samuel Adams' master's dissertation was what? It was a question. And the question was, is it lawful to stand against the authority if the Commonwealth, you know, cannot be saved? So that's my simplicity of the long, you know, his long dissertation title. And he answered in the affirmative, yes, it is lawful to stand against the authority if the Commonwealth cannot be saved. Wow, that was interesting. Now, you go back here to this writing that was done, let me get to the exact time frame of this writing. Let's see here. It is written, it was translated in 1689, but the original writing was back in the 1500s. And I'm trying to get to that date time frame for you. I don't have it. I don't know. We could say here it was probably around 1573-ish time frame. But so drawing back to Sam Adams' question at his master's degree, in front of all of the kingsmen, in front of the governor, all of those people at that time, here's this young guy that stands up and says, is it lawful to take and stand against the king, to stand against the established power, if the Commonwealth cannot otherwise be saved? And then he goes on to argue, and we don't have the details of his argument, but all of the historical writings referencing Sam Adams goes on to say that, yes, he answers in the affirmative, and to the extent that the governor of that time goes, this is a person we should watch out for in the future. But then they put him aside because there's a young guy. You know, what's he going to do? So here it is in this written article, or this written treatise by Duplessis Mornay, is the title A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants. And the first question, whether subjects are bound and ought to obey princes if they command that which is against the law of God. Now that becomes the ultimate aspect of the argument. But also, when you go back and you look at the writings of Samuel Adams in particular, that's exactly what he expresses. He expresses that. And we bring that out in SACPS in his what he spoke after the Declaration of Independence. So when we start looking at policy development and what that means relative to our very present time, Anti-Federalists understood that. Sam Adams understood it. It was very expressive, and it was an understanding because they understood history, which we don't teach correctly today. It's a bunch of numbers instead of what are all those interesting things around humanity that allow our history life so we don't repeat it. But come on back in the next segment of Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalists, they got it right. As I take you to even more recent history and what it means towards policy. So join me again as we enjoy Sam Adams. Welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. Yes, they did. They absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network with Tom Nivolis, your host. And yes, Liberty works for you right here on Liberty Works Radio Network. And I would ask that you take a look at everything that goes on here on Liberty Works Radio Network and participate. Yes, you know, this, I said that in the last segment, is that, you know, you get on the social media, you get on what's happening in the news, you watch all the stuff that I get in emails and da-da-da-da-da, and everybody's, you know, being Emmett. And, you know, there are a few people that are out there that are doing something. So, yeah, I'm going to ask you a couple times today to do something. I know that there's a number of you that do. You know, you're out there, you're active, you're doing everything that the founders said that we should do, is participate as citizens in our governance. That's our job. That's our responsibility. And we're going to touch on that here just in a minute in a different manner. But, hey, Liberty Works Radio Network, I'm thankful to be here. This is great. This is an opportunity, and it's opportunities for you to hear the expansive and different points of view. And you know what? There's some things on here that, you know, we don't agree with one another on, but that is the interesting aspects of what makes liberty function if it has defined purpose and truth, okay? It has to have the truth. It has to have that truth there. And Liberty Works Radio Network makes every effort to ensure that the hosts and hostesses on this network speak truth. Okay, so I'll leave it with that. Get involved. Check it out. Hit the donate button. You know, do something there as well as getting your feet out there and involved in your local community. Okay, so we talked about, and we did the introduction in the first segment about Sam Adams, his master's thesis, and then what we're seeing here that goes all the way back from the St. Bartholomew Massacre. All right? You need to understand this timeline on some things, and we're not going to get into all the details, but this is the expression of history. You know, I've got about five different books that I'm reading right now, as well as a little bit on all these other, this paper here from, what's his name, Duplessis Mornay, it's only about 78 pages long. I mean, that's not that long of a read. I mean, some of you can take and you can read it in your privy if you get to that and do that. But the point is that there's things out there that have a lot of meat to them that aren't that much to read. And yes, you know, I'll go back when I put everything, all my references up, is the reality that I do. I expect people to take and go learn on their own, you know. Don't be what we're going to talk about next. Now, I'm going to introduce you back into some of the writings of my very good friend. I mean, I really believe that this guy's like a soulmate in so many different ways to me, you know, when people use that expression. Some of the things that I like and where he comes off at, is he starts off with this whole thing on his writing, is that... But it would seem that if despotism were to be established amongst the democratic nations of our days, it might assume a different character. It would be more extensive and more mild. It would degrade men without tormenting them. I do not question that in an age of instruction and equality like our own, sovereigns might more easily succeed in collecting all political power into their own hands and might interfere more habitually and decidedly within their circle of private interests than any sovereign of antiquity could ever do. But this is the same principle of equality which facilitates despotism and tempers its rigor. We have seen how the manners of society become more humane and gentle in proportion as men become more equal and alike. When no member of the community has much power or much wealth, tyranny is, as it were, without opportunities in a field of action. All As all fortunes are scanty, and the passions of men are naturally circumscribed, their imagination limited, their pleasures simple, this universal moderation moderates the sovereign himself and checks within certain limits and the inordinate extent of his desires. But his independent reason, my friend kind of goes on to this whole thing, and he talks about society itself, and he might add that it's rising, its causes, you know, he's going to stick on subject, because he could go off. I mean, my friend is like me, he can go down a rabbit hole in a heartbeat. But he talks about this, and he's talking about a general global view, not, you know, and in some essence specific to America, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. But he talks in his generalization is that democratic governments may become violent and even cruel at certain periods of extreme eviscerance or of great danger. But these crises will be rare and brief. When I consider the petty passions of our contemporaries, the mildness of their manners, the extent of their education, the purity of their religion, the gentleness of their morality, their regular and industrious habits, and restraint which they almost all observe in their vices no less than their virtues, I have no fear that they will meet with tyrants in their rulers, but rather guardians. You see, that was interesting right there. When he talks about that idea that I have no fear that they will meet with tyrants in their rulers, but rather guardians. I think then that the species of oppression by which democratic nations are menaced is unlike anything which ever before existed in the world. Our contemporaries will find no prototype of it in their memories. I'm trying to myself to choose an expression which will accurately convey the whole of the idea I formed of it, but in vain. The old words despotism and tyranny are inappropriate. The things itself is new. And since I cannot name it, I must attempt to define it. I seek to trace the novel features under which despotism may appear in the world. The first thing that strikes the observation is the innumerable multitude of men, all equal and alike, endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures which they glut their lives. Each of them, living apart, is as a stranger to fate of all the rest of his children, his fellow man, and mankind. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, he is close to them, but he sees them not. He touches them, but feels them not. He exists but in himself and for himself alone. And if his kindred still remain to him, he may be said that at any rate have lost his country. Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power, which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratification and to watch over their fate. The power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood, but it seeks, on the contrary, to keep them in perpetual childhood. It is well content that the people should rejoice, provided they think of nothing but rejoicing. For their happiness, such government willingly labors, but it chooses to be the sole agent and the only arbiter of that happiness. It provides for their security, foresees and supplies their necessities, facilitates their pleasures, manages their principal concerns, directs their industry, regulates the descent of their property, and subdivides their inheritance. What remains but to spare them of all the care of thinking and all the trouble of living? Thus, it every day renders the exercise of the free agency of man less useful and less frequent. It circumscribes the will within the narrow range and gradually robs a man of all uses of himself. The principle of equality has prepared men for these things. It has predisposed men to endure them and oftentimes looks on them as benefits. I you know, I can take you through all of these things. There's a whole nother paragraph that I think I'm going to go to in the next segment, but you have to understand, and I'm going to reveal my friend's name. My friend's name is Alex de Tocqueville, and he wrote this after spending a number of years here in America, and this is out of his volume 2 on democracy in America. He looks at it not only from the global or those emerging democracies, but you have to understand that he is already seeing, and as well as Bastiat, that was a contemporary of his, watching what happened from the French Revolution all the way through and into where we are in that going through the Napoleonic period, and seeing the rise and fall of the various French so-called republics. Also, what we see at that time, and we know very, very clearly that is happening, is that socialism is predominant in Europe. We've seen that Fabianism has come to a high level of integration within England and made its transition into various areas. We see that Germany and a lot of the other nations in the continent have accepted, have gone away from God, have already made those transitions. And what we're seeing is even within Catholicism and the movements in Protestantism, that it is coming to what's in it for me. All right. And at that time, we know that Marx and Engels were doing all of their work. And the fact that Marx and Engels came out and published in when? Yeah, 1848, people remember. 1848 is when the Communist Manifesto came out. But that does not mean that all of the radical ideas of what became known as communism were not already there under Fabian socialism, as well as socialism in general, which has been experimenting already. And those are the things that he was talking about on that equality. And we saw it in America as well coming up. I mean, he saw that. And the next paragraph that I'm going to bring out to you also comes into effect, and we're going to bring that paragraph, very important paragraph, out in the next segment. But one of the things that I need to turn to, and I'm only got a couple minutes to finish up with, is that policy changes based on these ideas and people not being involved. And, you know, you got to go back and you got to get a copy of None Dare Call It Treason 25 years later. Because in there, it talks about everybody screaming, what happened to Trump's promises? What happened? Look at Trump. He's not doing this. He's not doing that. Well, look, you got a bunch of vacationing fools out there right now. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking about Congress. And then you have a greatest fool who should step down. This guy, is, in my mind, is continuously being, if I look at the founder's perspective, and again, the anti-federalist perspective, I will say that Paul Ryan is just on the cuspice of treason for what he's doing out there and trying to drive policy, especially in bringing back in the TIPP. Now, here we go. What happens with policy? I'm going to take you to page 353 of the None Dare Call It Treason 25 Years Later, chapter on the treaty trap, and here's what happened with Reagan's promises, okay? And real quick is that Reagan campaigned to keep the commies out, not to do any treaties with them, but by the time you start looking around in 86, things changed. We don't have a lot of time to get into that, but you know what happened with things changing? Is that all of a sudden Iran-Contra ousts Poindexter and Oliver North out of the NSC and brings in Frank Carlucci. Did you know that within 90 days of Frank Carlucci coming in there, he wiped out the NSC and he turned it from a strong anti-communist, anti-Russia perspective into accepting and tolerating. Well, didn't we just talk about accepting and tolerating and what the Tocqueville predicted? Well, the anti-federalists predicted that as well. You should read Mercy Owens and what she has to say about that. And we're going to come back in the next segment, and we're going to finish up with Alex de Tocqueville, and we're going to segue that in to finishing up on what happened to Ronald Reagan. So we're hoping, and you better hope, that Donald Trump is a stronger man than what Reagan was, and he keeps people in there that will stand strong on true principle. Come on back. Sam Adams has more to say. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They got it right here on the Liberty Works Radio Network with your host, Tom Nivolus. And one of the things that I am going to promote again at the end, as I get to it, is the Samuel Adams Center for what? Political science. Because when we look at policy, when we look at rounding it out, it comes to the idea of what's going on with our youth today that has not received any idea of this history. And I don't care if it's in private schools or even homeschools. It's so difficult because, you know, parents that do homeschooling do a great job. They get into more constitutionality. They do all of that. But yet, to be able to augment that as students learn and can comprehend that they can stand up for their rights in colleges, they can stand up for their rights in the schools, especially those that go to the public school system, and it is to stand up for what? Not only for our nation, but for their belief in God. And so, as before I get on to my friend de Tocqueville and finish off, hopefully, with some of the things on what happened to Reagan, and so it doesn't happen to Trump, is that I wanted to give you the last three questions that Duplessis Mornay wrote in this treatise. And here's the second question. So let's go back to the first question. First question was whether subjects are bound and ought to obey princes if they command that which is against the law of God. That was question number one. Question number two is that whether it be lawful to resist a prince who doth infringe the law of God or ruin his church, by whom, how, and how far is it lawful? Okay? And remember, this was in the 1500s when this was being written. All right? And the third question is that whether it be lawful to resist a prince who doth oppress or ruin a public state, and how far such resistance may be extended, by whom, how, and by what right or law is it permitted? Boy, that's exactly, almost to the detail extent, if you take Sam Adams, his thesis for his master's degree, oh boy, I can cut and paste that puppy right in there, right with that question number three. And then the fourth question is whether neighbor princes may or are bound by law to aid the subjects of other princes persecuted for true religion or oppressed by manifest tyranny. Wow. So one of the things that I want to say to any youth or that are listening or parents that have their kids in the public school system or the public indoctrination system is what I really call it, is that you have a right to resist. And if you go and you read these things and you read other historical components, you have that absolute right, especially in America, especially under our constitutional form of government, in this republic, based on foundational truths. Stop the nonsense in your school districts. Get out there and get involved and say, no, the civil liberties disunion, that's who they are because they're a communist organization, the ACLU, Civil Liberties Disunion, all of that stuff. They're communist organizations. They're out to destroy everything. And what has come into effectively some form of law, you have a right to resist it at every level and opportunity within the context of our form of governance. Our constitutional form of governments. You have that ability. But you got to do it. You got to do it. And you got to get the kahunas to do it. And the kahunas to do it is not pacifism and acceptance. It's not tolerance. It's the law of God. All right? You got to get that straight in your head first. And then go back and read what, you know, Duplessis Mornay was writing. I mean, it's simple. I'm going to put the reference. You're like, you got it. You got the reference already there. It'll be up. It's up on Facebook. It's up, you know, on all of the way that I send my references out. But let's now get back to today. And this is very important to understand, especially that the Democrats have risen to the level of power they have, and as you know, I say they've been corrupted. They've been corrupted by the Gramsciites, the Linskyites, and all of the others. And they're so happy to be corrupted by them. And so the godless Democrat party is this. And here's how what we become. Alex de Tocqueville predicted this as much as, and he describes this, as much as the Anti-Federalists predicted this. So let's see, what does he say? After everything, after having thus successfully taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioned them at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters penetrate to rise above the crowd. Get that right there? What do we see in all of these federal bureaucracies? Exactly that. Small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters penetrate to rise above the crowd. The will of man, he continues, is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses. It venerates, which means it weakens, it fatigues, or it exhausts. It extinguishes and stupefies a people, till each nation is reduced to being nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. So you've heard me when I've done this before, and I have quoted this before in other programs, is that here we have Alex de Tocqueville, who was the one that, you know, introduced the term, if you will, from this definition of sheeple. Here you have it. You people have been turned and reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. And that means even in your school board. So that's why I go back. Okay, sheeple, don't do anything. And you know what? When you go to the school board, don't stand up. Just sit there and listen and let them dictate to you what you're going to get, San Diego. All right. Continuing with our friend, Mr. de Tocqueville. I have always thought that servitude of a regular, quiet, and gentle kind, which I have just described, might be combined more easily than commonly believed with some of the outward forms of freedom, and that it might even establish itself under the wing of the sovereignty of the people. Our contemporaries are constantly excited by two conflicting passions. They want to be led, and they wish to remain free. As they cannot destroy either one or the other of these contrary propensities, they strive to satisfy them both at once. They devise a sole, tutelary, and all-powerful form of government, but elected by the people. They combine the principle of centralization and that of popular sovereignty. This gives them a respite. They console themselves for being in tutelage by the reflection that they have chosen their own guardians. Every man allows himself, and stop there. Remember what I said from the last segment, that he couldn't figure out another way to utilize the terminology of a tyrant or a despot, because it's not fitting that model any longer within republics. And in democratic republics in particular. So he came up with the idea that it's a guardian, that's what we have. And so here it is, he's saying that Yeah, you choose your own guardians. And he continues, every man allows himself to be put in the leading strings, which are straps at that time, which would support a child to learn how to walk. And because he sees that it is not a person or a class of persons, but the people at large that holds the ends of his chains. By this system, the people shake off their state of dependence just long enough to select their masters, these new guardians, and then relapse into it again. You know, so they're sitting on the couch. You're become the sheeple again. A great many persons at the present day are quite content with this sort of compromise between administrative despotism and the sovereignty of the people. And they think they have done enough for the protection of individual freedom when they have surrendered it to the power of the nation at large. This does not satisfy me. The nature of him I am to obey signifies less to me the fact that of extorted obedience. You see, the Anti-Federalist predicted exactly what he was talking about, especially in this last portion, that the people would be so dumbed down that you'd have administrative despotism in various different departments. And as I have said in other segments, and I mean other programs, is that, they're looking into your bathrooms, ladies. They're looking at what you wear, what you eat, what you do, everything like that. So this drives then to what's happening in so many different ways at a larger scale of the youth, what's going on, and who becomes the next policymakers. How do we raise up that next generation to do so? Because as I segued in the last segment, and we're running up against the end again here in this segment, is that Reagan made all these promises. So did Trump. But we have these conflicting things that are going on. We have these conflicting things is that Congress, you know, they're these creatures that became what the Anti-Federalists predicted they would become, especially with the Senate being the oligarchy that it is. And here, as I mentioned before, is that you had, you know, in the 80s, you had Reagan taken and campaigning on all of these issues that he wasn't pledged. He pledged that of no more treaties with the communists. You know, what's Trump pledging? All these different things. But what happened? What happened? And what happened was what I said, is that you had that transition because of Iran-Contra. That John Poindexter, Oliver North, you know, they went away. They went away. And all of a sudden, those that were holding true on policy now got changed out. Frank Carlucci, you know, he gets appointed to replace Poindexter as National Security Advisor. And after far-reaching effect, it transforms the whole attitude towards the Soviets. Within 90 days, much of the knowledgeable, hard-line, anti-communist, pro-American cadre assembled in the National Security Council in the early Reagan years was gone. There was a battle that went on. You know, you take and you look back is that under Poindexter, you had Grenada. We went in there and did what we did. You had the capture of the Achille Lauro killers. You had the battle for aiding the freedom fighters and anti-communists in Nicaragua and the raid on Gaddafi in Libya, which told the Marxist madman, no more terrorism. Okay? This is what happened. People forget that. That's what happened in the beginning of Reagan. And then what happens is, oh gosh, now we get this change out. And there was the battle between the deep state and the State Department, who is just infiltrated with leftists, okay? It has been. There's your shadow government that's been there for over 80 years, is in the State Department. And Reagan was getting some control on that. But boom, here we go. Because we change the NSC, next thing you know is that now we have that continuing battle and who's supporting what around the anti-communists. And because here it goes, is real simply, is that I don't have any more time. We're out of time. Go get the book, okay? Because what happens is the same thing that could happen in the Trump presidency. Trump goes in with all these promises. He's got Steve Bannon. And next thing you know, we're getting a change out right from day 3 of who's in NSC. What's going on now? How do we take the stances that we do for our liberties in our domestic policy? And we're going to come back next week to talk about policy and some more. And I'm going to follow up with this because I haven't had time to finish it. But come on back next week to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They absolutely got it right.